Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my commanding unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
No, I think everybody knows that I only play this kind of music when something big happens. And so joining me is the man who I refer to as the Burning Bush. And that's a Catholic thing, for those of you that don't get it. Retired Marine Corps General Anthony C. Zinni, known as Tony, to his friends. Sir, first of all, thanks for coming on All Marine Radio again, and how are you?
I'm doing well, Mac.
All right. Are you okay with being the Burning Bush? That's pretty high regard.
Yeah, pretty ominous.
It is pretty ominous. Now, I have to tell you that I first crossed paths, I'd never heard of Colonel Zinni, right? I'm walking across the campus of the basic school, out to do, like, patrolling from hell, right, from some lieutenant that told me that he's going to dead reckon, right? And then that's right before I grabbed his throat and said, we don't dead reckon here. And so Major John Kelly recently worked in the White House, for those of you who don't know. He looks at me and says, hey, are you going to go see Colonel Zinni tonight? And I said, like, come on, sir, another colonel, like, going to run his yap at the base of school? Should I go? And he said, go to this. So that PME, I would tell you, is the best PME I've ever been to in my life. And it was a really interesting time in Marine Corps history because of the debate about maneuver warfare was going on,
right.
and you came through, and it was awesome. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to play about 4 minutes of audio from that that I did today, and it's you talking about, and I had read, like, most before the internet got going, right? The way we found out about stuff is we read books, and so I think this is it. Hold on.
Over LAI account. They don't do Windows, you know.
Okay, this is it. So I'm sitting there, and this guy comes in. Right, he's Italian. He's a colonel. I just got it done with 9th Marines, and he's coming back to Quantico, and I don't know him from shit, and. And I have to tell you, sir, funny as hell. You were busting Bill Lynn's balls all night, which we all loved, right? You made fun of General Van Riper, which nobody did. One of the funniest things he said that night was you were talking about your officer school in Okinawa, And you said, I had three guys one night. They had a shit pot full of Silver Star Navy crosses, decorated guys. They called one the Prussian. They called one the surfer and one the philosopher. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then General Riper's sitting to his left, and he looks over at him, and he says, don't wax your board, General. And the whole room fell out because General Van Riper, I didn't know. What I knew of him is that he was the most uptight white guy on the planet, right? And he was, I mean, he had some serious rules, and you didn't violate them. So I want to play about 4 minutes of this because this is – no internet, you read books, and then this is Colonel Zinni talking about about Iwo Jima. And it starts with a little bit of a discussion about LAR and roles and missions. So bear with me for 4 minutes.
You're a maneuver element, y'all. We always go together as one package. Screw you, Jack. You may be back there in rear area security. I love reading Battle of Iwo Jima. Reconnaissance battalion had rear area security, so 512 Japanese and one wing back there. So I was recon in rear area security. What the hell else are you going to do with them? Put a recon team out, you know, 2 meters in front of them? I mean, that's the last package. That's the way of thinking. You do what you have to do with what you got, you know? And you're not bound up by some goddamn dogma on organization or mission or the way you have to do things. You can't be that way. I went to Iwo Jima, the island, about 8 times when I was out there. What a fascinating place. If you guys have ever been there, I mean, I've taken a ton of sand off that place to increase my household weight allowance by about 50,000 pounds. I went to the spot where the Noah John Bastion was built and dug a hole and brought it back with me. You know, I became fascinated by that battle because of the island being untouched. You know, Van Riper and I, we crawled through the caves, you know, all the things that are still there. And just the sheer the amount of violence and shock and the things that went on there are just staggering the imagination. There was a Marine there that practiced maneuver warfare. In the midst of probably the greatest attrition battle in our history as a Corps, there was a maneuverist on that island. It was General Graves B. Erskine. And I want you to read about the 3rd Marine Division in the Senate. And I want you to read about that general and what he did in his decision. It was the essence of maneuver warfare. And you want to talk about not getting hung up with a lot of mobility and distance. We're talking about movements of, you know, 10, 20 yards. A form of maneuver done in that kind of post. Let me tell you some of the things Erskine did. Number one in relation to this. He was continually shifting organizations. He put all 26 of his tanks to one battalion on one side. Then he'd spread them out and divide them up evenly. Then he'd pack them up together and move them again. He took the mortars all out of battalions and regiments and gave them all to one regiment. All the mortars. You imagine that somebody come down and say, oh, your mortars are going, 9-3, they're all going over here. You know? And he was continuously screwing with the organization shift. He was the only guy that made ground. He bitched the cage to Rocky because those suckers couldn't keep up. He was going to shoot one of them one time. You know, I got the oral history, Graves B. Erskine's oral history, and it's tremendous to read about. He didn't give a shit about the boundaries. I want to talk about that. He kept calling up cages and saying, I'm taking that hill with fingers on. And of course, the 4th Division commander was just reacting to all this. Yeah, you got it. Change the boundary. He wasn't worried about it. Set 9 units off to take one of the hills in his own. He wasn't worried about where boundaries were. I'm going to talk about control measures in a second. He also was imaginative. He would create scenes. He'd create maneuvers. What he would do is he'd run an attack with maybe 2 battalions. One battalion would make progress, and one would be a little held up. He'd run another one through the gap. He was doing these little turning movements in his belt. It's all over. When you follow the flow of the battle in any of these history books, you go crazy trying to follow 3rd Division because these little battalion things pop up all over the place. He calls Colonel Kenyon in, steal the 9th Marine, one of our predecessors, and about the middle of the fight, he says, hey, Kenyon, we're going to do a night attack. What do you think of that? Kenyon goes, you're going to kid me. A night attack? Yeah. But he says, not yet. It's only one time it's going to work. We're going to pick the right time to do the night attack. The night attack is going to be the coup de grace. And he did. One of the battalions in 9th Marine. When he had to break the last ridge line, the last pocket, he did the night attack. The poor guy who went and did it missed the objective. He attacked the wrong hill. Woke up the next morning, dawned, and he said, holy shit, I'm on the wrong hill. The
Japanese were so surprised that they had never seen a night attack, they just moved to the next, to the real hill, no problem. And they completely broke all the resistance in his area. Made it to the far side of Iwo Jima, and then got told to clear the 5th Division zone, too, but they couldn't make it. His response was to the division's man, how are you going to do it? He says, you got to do it. I'm ordering you to do it. He said, well, there's none of these cooperative exercises. That bastard senior man, I don't like you. You give me the zone. So he gave him the zone. He says, if you got about 4 days to do this, take your whole division up. He says, I'll do it in half a day with one regiment. So he called the regimental commander and says, you're going to do it in half a day with one regiment. You've got to be shot. He did it without 17 casualties. Cleaned up the last resistance up there towards Bloody Gorge. But read about Erskine, the very essence of maneuver warfare. Not in Cax Flight 29 Tom's, you know, Russian Steps maneuver. Read about the 1st Marine Brigade in Korea.
So that was my introduction to then Colonel Zinni and his thoughts on Iwo Jima. And he gives some advice later on in the PME about picking a battle and learn everything you can about it. So I took that to heart. And so this interview is years in the making. How did you first get interested in Iwo Jima?
Well, it actually was due to General Van Riper. He was Colonel Van Riper on Okinawa, the chief of staff of the MEF, and the division. And he instituted a program where each of us colonels out there had to take a battle in the Pacific, really bone up on the battle, and then go out and visit it, walk the ground, and then take out groups of officers and NCOs to the island or wherever the action was, and walk them through on a staff ride. So mine was Iwo Jima. So I went out there several times, actually met one of the Japanese officers that had been there, a naval officer who was one of the last ones to leave the island before the invasion, and got to know the island really well. Actually went out there with a Japanese general at one point that was their director of training, who was a student of the battle as well. And then I took several groups of Marines from Okinawa out there, and we went through the battle. So as we went through this, it was not only reading about it and hearing about it, sort of getting the both sides' perspective, but also getting into the personalities and the leadership. And Grace B. Erskine was somebody who really really felt strongly about his leadership that never got much attention. But since he had been the CO in 9th Marines, which I could relate to, that's what I was at the time, I really got into understanding who he was, and he's an amazing individual, and what he did on Okinawa, you know, really, at the time we were looking, as you pointed out, at maneuver warfare and changing our style of operations, I saw him bring that concept down to a tactical level, because there was no great space for a grand maneuver in any way, and he was looking how to leverage that idea and concept down to the smallest tactical level. And he was in the center of the line. The Marines had tried to take the island with just 2 divisions, realized that wouldn't work. They did not want to commit the 3rd Division. He was in command of the 3rd Division, trying to save it for the Okinawa or for the invasion of Japan. But they had to commit 2 of its regiments, and so he went ashore. And he was put into the center of the line, and that's really what broke the spine of the series of Japanese defensive lines.
Talk to me about, it's kind of interesting, I recall, I've never forgotten some of the stuff from that PME that night. One of the things that you were talking about was command and control, how we do it in the Marine Corps, and I believe I'm quoting you correctly when you said, what you're trying to convince me of is that you've got a system and we can plug anybody into that. And what I'm going to tell you is the most important element of command is the commander. So with that, is that relatively accurate?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about the personalities. And I'm really curious about what you learned from the Japanese side, because, you know, when you go looking for Japanese sources and writings about Iwo Jima, you have to look long and hard. It's not easy to find you know, things that have been written from their perspective. And it certainly wasn't anything close to easy before the internet was created. So I'm curious, what did you find in your conversations with the Japanese officers that you met?
Well, it began with the Japanese commander on Iwo Jima, General Kobayashi. He was one of their finest generals. I mean, he was regarded highly as an operational general. He fought in China, and had a reputation of really being tough and hard. He was sent, specifically to Okinawa because they knew he would fight to the death, but not fight to the death in a way that they had been in stupid bonsai charges and mass attacks and defending right on the beach. They wanted him to fight to the end, so that, the Americans might be, in their mind, discouraged from invading mainland Japan. Iwo Jima was actually part of the prefecture of Tokyo, so it was the first piece of actual Japanese ground that we took. So it had a psychological significance. And Tojo and the others wanted any Americans to pay a big price on that island. And he was masterful in the way he controlled the urge by many of his subordinate commanders to just go out in headlong charges, did not defend on the beach. They had asked advice of the Germans and others because they had seen that defending right on the beaches was pointless against the firepower that our military had. So he defended inland. He let Marines land, and then he tried to bottle them up on the beaches, which worked to a degree. And then he had this tremendous tunnel system and fortified lines that were dug in. He brought engineers from Japan. They had to vent this tunnel system because this was, I mean, the meaning of Iwo Jima is Sulfur Island, and the sulfur fumes were overwhelming. So they had to build in a system that self-ventilated, too. 9 years after the battle, there were still Japanese soldiers coming out of those tunnels. So it says something about the intricate nature of what they built. And I've been through some of them. Most of them obviously were closed and bottled up right after the end of the battle. They were sealed. And for a lot of reasons, they don't want people trying to dig in or go into there. One is because of the Japanese feeling about it. It's sacred ground. The other is obviously unexploded ordnance that's all over the island. You just scrape your foot and you're going to see shell casings and all kinds of ordnance. So he was, he was put in there as the commander they best thought could inflict so much damage and so many casualties that there would not be a desire to invade mainland Japan, because that would be an example of what they faced.
Could you give us, when you look at maps, you'll see sectors of how they defended. Can you give me a sense of the overall scheme of the defense that he put in, other than simply kill 10 Americans before you're killed?
Right. If you can imagine, if you haven't seen a map of Iwo Jima, it's kind of shaped like a pork chop. You know, it sort of tapered at one end with Mount Suribachi at that end, and then it sort of expands out and then comes back, almost like a kite in shape. And it's very narrow, only about 8 miles long, and very narrow in places. The disadvantage was there was really only one invasion beach. There was an alternate one that the Navy looked at, and it was on the other side of the island, almost the same place across the island at its narrowest neck from the invasion beaches they were using. But that invasion beach that they used was really the only one with the size and the ability to put the number of troops across we had to. So the disadvantage in the beginning was that Kobayashi knew where you were going to land. So he built his defenses accordingly. And so he reinforced Suribachi, of course, but his real defensive lines or bands went from the invasion beaches and turned to the right and went up to the larger part of the island. And they were built in systems across the island. It was impossible to turn using the sea, the lines, because the rocky nature of the shorelines and the inability of the land forces either on a flank or behind them. So he basically knew that where the landing would come and the direction of attack that would come at them, and basically they fought back on those defensive lines. Again, the objective to inflict as many casualties as possible.
How was our scheme of maneuver different? Going ashore, a lot of focus on Mount Suribachi, obviously, that dominates the southern part of the island. But you know, when you look at it from the Japanese perspective, they know that that thing's not going to hold out for very long. I mean, they hope it'll hold out for as long as it can, but at the end of the day, they know it's going to be quickly cut off. Talk about the American scheme maneuver. Anything unique about it?
You know, and of course, the American scheme maneuver was to land, and one part of the force goes south to take the Suribachi, and the other to turn north as the main effort going up the island and through those defensive bands. There was, I think, hope on the part of many of the planners that the naval and air bombardment would be significant. I don't think there was a realization as to how intricate the defenses were and the engineering that went into building them and the underground complex that was on the island. In many cases, the Navy thought, you know, this the naval gunfire in the air had pretty much left nothing standing. But, of course, as soon as the first Marines that made it on the other side of the beach realized right away that the bunkers were still intact and naval gunfire and air hadn't had that much of an effect, and they weren't under fire. They weren't under fire right away, but that's because Kobayashi wanted them to land a lot of troops and then bottle them up, so they were bunched up and concentrated on the beaches, and therefore his indirect fire and direct fire weapons that were in bunkers and blockhouses could hit the beach. And of course, he felt with Suribachi in the south and his first line in the north, he had a crossfire, which he did, on the beaches, and the casualties would be high. The island, it moves. It actually has risen 52 feet since the end of the war. So when you're down on the invasion beaches, you can actually see old Amtraks and landing craft and things coming out of the sand. I mean, it's really eerie when you see this. The island now is deceptive because basically when they landed, there was no vegetation or anything. But after the war, they planted kudzu all over the island. So much of it is covered with this stuff. And if you know what kudzu is, because you see a lot of it in the south here in the U.S. and everything, it's vines and pretty heavy and green. But that belies the way the terrain was then, because it was very rocky and sandy, and it was difficult to pick out pillboxes and bunkers and things that were built in and connected through this intricate tunnel system.
I've got an email question. Mac, first of all, I've been waiting for this since you said the general was going to come on, and very, very cool. Thank you very much for doing this, sir. My question is this. He mentioned a few minutes ago that he went through the tunnels. As somebody who's never been on the island and hates everybody who has been on the island, what were those tunnels like? Were they hot? Were they narrow for the average American? Could you get through them? So I'm with him, sir. I hate everybody who's been on the island because I've never been. And so what were the tunnels like?
The tunnels were amazing. Like I said, you can't go through the entire network because they were sealed and blocked off right. And deliberately now. They don't want anybody in there. But you could go through some of them. One of the areas that was most interesting, most of the prisoners that were taken, and there were very few, were from a hospital that was on the opposite side of the island from the invasion beaches and up in the north. And when you go in, the hospital is the tunnel complex. It's open, and it is there are huge open rooms in there, if you will. As a matter of fact, when they were first uncovered, they found a Marine on a gurney with an IV in there, who was obviously died. And most of the survivors, POWs, had identified where the hospital is, and they make up most of the Japanese that come back for the reunions and all. And again, there aren't many of them from that one unit. So you can see, get a perspective from there of the size of these things. Now, there were places where the tunnels narrowed, usually in connecting branches of the tunnels, but they did open up to significant size, rooms and areas where they, obviously did everything from their hospital work, their administration, their logistics, their eating, and everything else. So it was an amazing network. And like I said before, it had to be done in different levels so it would self-ventilate because of the sulfur. So a lot of engineering work went into it. As a matter of fact, the one survivor who became a Buddhist monk went back to the island and sort of sanctified the sites, both for Marines and for the Japanese soldiers. He was a Navy captain who slapped one of his subordinate officers and was relieved of duty and went out on the last ship. And he felt a sense of guilt. That's why he became a Buddhist monk and went back. But the reason he slapped the officer was interesting, because Koribayashi in the Army said, there's no point in keep trying to repair the runways and the airfield. They're going to bomb it, and we'll never keep repairing it enough to be effective. So all the material that the Japanese Navy force had there, they wanted for the tunneling complex. And the Navy was resisting that. So this young Japanese infantry officer came up wanting the material, and this junior Japanese Navy officer refused to give it to him. And that's when this Japanese Navy captain slapped him, because he said, you're stupid, you don't understand. He's right. We can never stay above ground and keep this up under what's coming and what we've been hit with so far. So he was relieved of duty by his senior and put on the last ship that made it out from Iwo Jima.
Wow. My guest is Tony Zinni, General of the United States Marine Corps, retired, and we're talking about Iwo Jima. So talk about things that I'm curious. So the scheme of maneuver, Marines go ashore, 28th Marines heads up Mount Suribachi. Anything about that? I mean, slugging Tony Stein and his Stinger, slugging across the base of Mount Suribachi, John Bazalone killed on day one. Anything in particular about the seizing of Mount Suribachi that interests you more than the rest of it?
Well, you mentioned John Bazalone. I wanted to try to determine the spot where he was killed. And, you know, reading the accounts and everything as best I can, I found what I thought was at least the vicinity where he was killed, because he ran up and jumped on top of a pillbox and, you know, was trying to get his machine gunners up in position. And of course, received his Navy Cross there. I think it was started out as Silver Star, became a Navy Cross, along with his Medal of Honor for Guadalcanal. So he was, like you said, he was on the first day, you know, when they were getting pinned down on the beach, and he was trying to find a way to break the line of fire they were facing and try to get his machine guns in position. On Suribachi, you know, it was just slugging up the hill, and the problem they had was the Japanese soldiers kept popping up behind them. That's when they had, I think, the first realization that this wasn't, you know, that the naval gunfire in the air did not do much to their defenses, because they were so well dug in. So Suribachi gave them their first taste of that, that in many cases they were waiting underground and allowing the Marines to pass and then coming up behind them and coming out from there. So it was clear the nature of the fight was going to be this sort of slug it out, position by position, inch by inch. And they had to adjust their tactics, you know, as they turned north after they pretty much had secured Suribachi, although fighting on there went on for a while. They had to adapt their tactics. They used what they had developed and called the corkscrew tactics. Corkscrew tactics was the combination of flamethrowers, demolition and something to blind the enemy, you know, smoke grenades or white phosphorus. So, you know, the old blind them, blast them, and blind them, burn them, and blast them. You know, the old, that's what I remember first when I first went to in the Marine Corps, that they used to teach us. We have to lug that huge and gigantic and heavy flamethrower around and light the match and then send it out, you know, or you were the white phosphorus thrower. And as I remember, my first instructor said, I don't want any Alice arms trying to heave this grenade because it was pretty heavy. And I think the circular error probable on those white phosphorus grenades exceeded the normal throwing range of the average guy. And then obviously the demolitions. And this was being done by infantry guys. So it wasn't really like an engineer requirement or anything like that. This was equipment that had been given to them that they had very little training on. So when you look at some of the Medal of Honor recipients out there that grabbed the flamethrowers or grabbed the demolitions, they weren't experts in all this, and they were trying to figure it out, but they knew that sort of sequence. And so the idea of how to take down pillboxes, if you will, or bunkers had been established from previous landings. But it was really tough because that was the tactic that you had to master there when you hit these lines. And you never knew where the openings were because it was so rocky and they had camouflaged it so well that you didn't know where they might pop out. And wherever they popped out, they were behind a lot of either concrete or behind a lot of rocks and things in the formation. So, you know, they weren't direct fire weapons weren't going to do much to them. You're going to really have to get up close and use the flamethrowers and the demolitions.
I want to talk to you about as the 4th and the 5th Division head to the north, generally north on the island. On the left hand side, on the eastern side, in front of the 5th Division, is this natural fortress called Hill 362 Alpha. On the right flank, I mean, if you chart the advance of the 4th Marine Division, they go nowhere. They land, they turn right, and if you look at their advance over day after day after day, they are literally moving in yards as they run into the amphitheater, the meat grinder, Turkey Knob, and a whole bunker complex along that right hand flank of the Marines. And then I want to talk about that. And in the midst of that, the 3rd Division goes into the center. And I also want you to, if you wouldn't mind, you know, the casualty rates are so high that the skills that you're talking about that have to be mastered to stay alive in terms of blind and burn and blast them, you're constantly regenerating those skills because those guys are gone. So talk about that kind of 362 on the left, on the right, that series of absolute impregnable features that the Japanese had put in, coupled with the terrain, and then the 3rd Division, and then the turnover.
Yeah. Well, when you follow the trace on the right side, you immediately realize why they call it the amphitheater, because you come out into this sort of C or U-shaped rock formation, which means that you have to kind of go down into an amphitheater like piece of terrain and come up it again. And of course, at every level all throughout that area, they have built-in bunker tunnel complexes, and you're under constant fire. So the gains are made literally in inches as you're trying to move on. And it's extremely difficult. One of the things which kind of was implied in your question too was how they viewed replacements. There was a debate about replacements, not just pumping new guys into units as you're receiving casualties, but try to keep the units together and do unit replacement. But they couldn't do that. There were so many casualties that the troops that they had brought in to be the fillers had to be put up in the lines right away. So there was this constant casualty rate amongst the veterans and the first in to fight and new guys coming up and in, which means those tactics have to be relearned or passed on. And of course you have the constant changes in the organization and right away that obviously affects morale and camaraderie and everything else. And it says a lot for maybe the Marine culture in that everybody understands what they are and who they are. So when they come in, even though it's a new guy, there's a strong belief that, you know, you're a Marine and that this is what you have to do. But that constant replenishment and replacement coming up from the replacement units also generated a number of problems. And a lot of times they took the heaviest casualties, too, because if you survive by the time you're on the island for a week or so, you probably learned enough that might get you through. But somebody coming up for the first time was going to have to gain that experience. And if you don't get it from the veterans that are up there that have been fighting for a while, you're going to become a casualty pretty quickly. So that, you know, that's one reason why the Marines had created such big rifle squads. And there was criticism of the Marines for having squads that were too big. But the Marines had the big squad so they could absorb the casualties because of the nature of the operations they were facing in those landings in the Pacific.
Pretty interesting discussion about the Marine Corps rifle squad shrinking again and your ability to take a casualty when you're smaller. And that's if you're TO and you're smaller. We all know that most of the time we go a little bit less than TO. And so that debate continues continues to this time. Are you? Do you like bigger squads or smaller squads?
I'm a bigger squad guy. I mean, I like, you know, it all revolved around the fire team concept, which was developed when the Marines were learning to build the Raider units at Quantico. 3-5 and other units were brought back to Quantico because at the beginning of the war, Roosevelt felt we wouldn't be on the offense in the Pacific, we'd be on the defense, and that he used the model that Churchill used in that conduct raids to keep morale up and keep the enemy off balance. So he saw the Pacific as a series of raids. That's why the Marine Raider battalions were created in the Paramarines. And in trying to develop those kinds of units, and he and his son, of course, who commanded one of the Raider battalions eventually, sure, were enamored with the Royal Marines, and so they were looking to do that kind of operation in the Pacific. But once they took Guadalcanal and actually held it, which was a close thing, and Vandegrift was able to hold it, it switched over to an offensive. At the same time, the Australians were able to defeat the Japanese on New Guinea, so that's when they sort of went away from that. The Marine Corps never liked that idea. Most of the senior general officers were opposed to raiders, and they didn't use the term special operations in those days, but they just felt that they can do it with Marines in their normal structure, and they didn't need these special units. And, of course, eventually the raiders just became absorbed into the conventional, if you use that term, right, regular infantry and division formations that we had.
Talk to us about as the division, as the 4th and 5th Division try to make ground, the 3rd Division is introduced. Why only two, if you're going to commit them, why only two regiments of the 3rd Marine Division?
Well, they were very reluctant to commit the 3rd Division. They were really, at that stage of the game, they were really looking at the invasion of Japan. And the only question is whether it would be MacArthur's approach to take Formosa first as a jump-off point or Nimitz on Okinawa. But they were looking ahead to the big operation, if you will, in Japan, landing in Japan. So they did not want to take high casualties in units that they wanted to preserve for that landing, because the numbers and the structure that they felt they needed was really growing. So they were trying to hold back the 3rd Division and not use it. So when it was obvious that they needed more forces ashore, instead of put the whole division in, they just went with a regiment, one regiment really in the center, another regiment that they brought in. But they were trying to hold back, even if they could only hold back regiments, at least regiments that were, you know, unbloodied.
Right. So talk to us about... obviously, you're a fan of General Erskine.
Yes.
Talk to us about what you see in General Erskine, because you know, in the PME that I saw, you do a fantastic job of using your sense of humor to hook the schmoes like me. And as you weave in and out of intellectual content, you do a fair amount of entertaining. And one of the things, you know, the thing that you say right before the thing about, you know, LAR doesn't do windows, he tells a story about a NATO exercise in Germany where they were going to use TOWS in an offensive capacity. And he draws a parallel between Rommel's air defense artillery officer coming up and saying to Rommel, "Sir, the 88 cannot be used in an anti-tank mode." And everybody laughs. And then he draws a parallel between reconnaissance in rear air security. Talk to us about General Erskine's. Talk to us about what the third division did. Pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Well, General Erskine, I was first sort of attracted to him because he had been one of the previous commanders of the 9th Marines and actually had established the 9th Marines logo and slogan and all that. So it got me curious as to who he was. I looked him up, and he had retired as a four-star general. And, of course, at that time, the only four-star generals were Vandegrift and eventually a Colin Mann Smith after retirement. And as I looked him up more, I realized that in the Marine Corps, he was regarded as one of the most brilliant officers we had at the time. Rare at that time was for a Marine officer, senior officer, to go to a war college. And he did. And so he had a tremendous amount of professional military education. He spent unusual time on large staffs, not just Marine Corps staffs. And so his reputation was one of being brilliant in terms of the operational art, but having an intellectual level that was not the norm, of course, at the time, and an education level that certainly wasn't the norm. It was rare, in fact. So, you know, he had a hard time getting command. He had to keep fighting for it because everybody wanted him on a staff somewhere, a senior level staff, because of all that. So his ability to sort of argue and fight for a regiment and then a division made it tough. And so when he obviously got ashore, which he didn't think he would at that time, and then get put in the center, he really brought his creative thinking into play. He realized that, as I said before, this wasn't going to be a fight of maneuver, but he thought about how he can get an edge, and he felt if he can gain a flank, even if it's a matter of meters, he can turn that flank. So what he convinced his troops to do is if you penetrate even a few meters or a little more, immediately look at how we turn the flank that you've exposed on the enemy. So it whatever he had to do to reinforce that ability to take advantage of that small flanking movement, he did. And that's where it came in, where he shifted weapon systems, even from even out of the regiment or across battalions, massing mortars on with one unit, then moving to somewhere else, and putting units in reinforcing other units where they had a little bit of edge. So he was making progress down the middle by this left and right small flanking movements. And then, of course, the incident that in the tape that you had there of the night attack, where he decided that he was going to do a night attack. And, of course, when he told that battalion commander, "You're going to do a night attack," and he said, "Really?" You know, because at night you went to, because people came out of their holes, you went to the ground and stayed up all night trying to kill people trying to kill you. And then when the battalion commander asked him, what's my objective? What am I going to do it? He said, "I don't know, but you're going to do a night attack. So get ready because there'll be that moment." And it was a success.
Sir, had you ever
been done?
Had you ever heard of the Marine Corps doing anything at night other than getting in your holes and shooting anybody who wasn't in your hole at night previous to that in the war?
Well, actually, Belleau Wood was a night attack. And 3-5, was told to attack the salient at night. They were wandering around trying to figure out what the shortest distance into the enemy line was, because it's all surrounded by wheat fields. And right before first light, because they were getting anxious because they were losing darkness, the battalion commander finally said, "We can't sort that out. We're just going to attack right here." And when they attacked across the wheat field, it was the shortest distance, just out of luck, to go into that salient that the Germans had established. So they had, they in the past, they had experience with night operations. Of course, on the islands like that, because of the nature of the enemy and the short distances and lack of ability for major maneuver, they, you know, there wasn't much of that. But the Marines and the Army had a different approach. This is what got Colin Mann Smith into trouble when he released Ralph Smith on Saipan.
Mm-hmm.
Marine doctrine was to bypass enemy, to get to the other end. Again, they're islands, but clean it out, get to the right, to the end, then come back and clean up what you missed. Army doctrine was not to, to leave anything in your rear, to move methodically and clean it out. And that was part of the problem that Ralph Smith, the division commander of that relieved Army, and Holland Mann Smith had on Saipan. He felt he wasn't moving fast enough, but actually he was trying to clean out every position, where the Marines, that was not their doctrine. They raced through, isolated, and bypassed and went back to clean it up. So, you know, using the night and staying on the offensive and being aggressive was their methodology. It got a lot of criticism because of the casualties some people felt it took. The Marines felt it shortened the number of casualties you take because you defeat the enemy right away and don't give them a chance to regroup and get into this sort of grinder kind of operation. So there was a debate about that that even went past the war and it carried on after that.
So because one thing you say that is absolutely true, when you try to follow battalions by day, and so you're reading histories and you got a map and you're moving pins or you have little placards in a PowerPoint presentation, trying to follow what happens as they head to the northern part of the island with the 3rd Division, it's like, wait a minute, how did they get there? Because yesterday they were here. And you're trying to follow battalions, and it is maddening, and these turning movements and the way that the 3rd Division is doing that. How do they sustain themselves? I mean, the average unit 2.5 times, right? I mean, they turn over 2.5 times, which gives you some idea of the amount of casualties, because some guys, for instance, you know, Sledge makes it through, doesn't even get a Purple Heart. Both Saipan and Okinawa, which, when you think about the millions of pieces of metal that flew around those islands, absolutely amazing that he never gets touched in those things. So, how do you continue that? It's just, they got to be trained, and you got to have iron will at that point when you get 2/3 of the way done with the fight, and you're constantly feeding in new guys who've got to learn. Is it anything but its stiff spine that gets it done?
Yeah, I mean, that was the mindset of the time. I mean, that was the nature of the fight. It got to Holland Mann Smith. I mean, he eventually, Nimitz eventually, you know, after the Ralph Smith incident and all, sending back to Hawaii, because when they landed in Okinawa, of course, it was 10th Corps commanded by Buckner, and then when he was killed by Roy Geiger, you know, Marine. But Geiger became really the forward warfighter. Holland Mann Smith was sent back because the number of casualties was really beginning to get to him and affect him. He was blaming the enemy, the Navy, and the way that they were employed, the lack of support, but it was clear some of the officers felt he had some deep depression problems and other things as a result of the casualties, but it was the accepted way to do business. I mean, when you think about, they had experienced Tarawa and Peleliu and Guadalcanal, so by the time they're fighting on Iwo Jima and then eventually Okinawa, there was this grim understanding that this was going to be the nature of the fight, and you were going to get these casualties. I mean, it's hard to think about now how that could be done, but that was the way the fight went.
Talk to me about what fascinates you all these years later when you think about Iwo Jima. There's so many different ways and things that I find fascinating about the battle. And now I think it's so cool because now with the internet, I mean, you can, if you want to have an interesting, spend a few hours, just type in Iwo Jima, general search, click on pictures, and just start looking for pictures you've never seen before. And you find them, and it's amazing. What still fascinates you about the battle, sir?
Well, probably the most impressive thing is when you're on the island and you think about 75,000 troops, and you look at the size of that island, 8 by 2, 8 by 2.5 miles, and you're thinking about all those troops packed into that island fighting, and all the weapon systems that are unleashed, and all the ordnance. Like I said, you just walk, take a step and brush your feet into the black sand, and you're going to see casings come up right away. The island's just covered with it. One of the interesting things about the island is there was this huge sinkhole on the island, because it was volcanic. And toward the end of the war, when they had all this equipment and they knew they were going to have to bring it back to the States, the decision was made not to bring it back because they felt, you know, with all the jeeps and bulldozers and things like that, if it came on the commercial market back in the States, it would cause a depression. So they decided to ditch it. A lot of it was ditched at sea, but a lot of it was thrown into this huge sinkhole, and it became known as the million-dollar hole. You know, they put into it. And like I said, the island is rising, so you can see terrain differences from the map and what it is now, and the nature of fighting in that sand, and that sulfuric black sand is very slippery. So when you see those pictures of the Marines that land and they're packed on the beach and they're fighting and you're looking at them trying to get out of the sand and you see them slipping back, the sand doesn't give you any traction or ability to move, and you can't really dig in because the sides collapse too. So I guess for me, the biggest, and then when you go inland and you see the rocky formations and you're trying to pick out a bunker or a position in there, which is almost impossible to see. You just have to see the fire coming out or the weapons being fired before you can even get any sense of where it might be. And like I said, the Japanese had the discipline, and they were told to wait sometimes until the Marine lines pass them and then come up behind. So you're actually having to go behind or with no real rear area there. That whole business of the terrain is what I think had the biggest impact on me when I went out there and physically was on the island.
I'm curious about your reaction. 70 years later, we're still unscrewing the public affairs officers and their contribution to the fight and re-identifying. The story about the re-identification is fascinating to me because, you know, I interviewed the Irish, amateur Irish historian fascinated with the Pacific and the Marine Corps, who's on disability and starts looking at pictures. And he's looking at pictures, and he sees Bradley's uniform on top of Suribachi after the first flag raising and says, holy shit, that's not the guy in the picture.
Yeah.
And I looked at that picture of Bradley with his back to the camera, his Unit 3 slung bandolier style, his leggings on, his pants cuffed, no wire cutters. And you have to look at it for all of 30 seconds to think, holy shit. That's not him. I'm curious your thoughts about all that, the re-identification.
Well, I think first of all, there's two flag raising, so that creates a problem right away. Then, you know, nobody is thinking this is the iconic moment. I mean, they did the second one because the photographer says, obviously, let me get another picture raising another flag. No one's thinking about it. Then later on, when everybody realizes this is on the front page of every newspaper, this is the iconic picture. Obviously, in those days, for the folks back home, everybody was after the heroic symbols. People are trying to go out and identify them. And, of course, a good number of them, both flag raisings, are killed in the battle later on.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine at the base, Putney, for a long time, they had misidentified him, and his mother kept saying, that's my son. They kept telling her, no. That's not your son. We know because her son was killed there. And she identified him by his backside. She said, I diapered that backside. I know it. That's my son. Turned out she was right. So, you know, a mother's sense is something you ought to trust 100%. So there was a lot of confusion because no one was thinking that this was going to be something so significant that, you know, you had to make sure you had the names right. And then some of them are not around. The two flag raisings got confused. So you can understand what happens. I mean, I think they're still sorting through some that they're not sure of.
Right. In fact, one of the things he said, which was, he said the Marine Corps is still working on it. I interviewed him a week ago. He said, and I think there's going to be more information coming, a more complete discussion of both flag raisings, which the controversy doesn't seem to diminish. I just think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating from a mental health perspective because I don't think there was any doubt in Bradley's mind that he's not in that picture. Because I think
he raised the flag.
Right. He knows he's up there and he goes on the war bond tour. But then I'm sure as he's looking at the sculpture and he's looking at that picture and if I gave you your deuce gear from Vietnam, either one of your times there, do you think you could put it back together today the way you pretty much wore it then?
No.
Yeah. Well, so to me, Bradley looking at that picture sees, I never had wire cutters, and I had my leggings on and my pants cuffed. That's not me. But he couldn't say anything. So to me, Bradley almost becomes a tragic figure in all of this because there's no doubt in my mind, he knows that's not him, but he can't say anything, and he just goes back to Wisconsin. He's an undertaker and is a Navy Cross recipient, and he lives a great life. But it seems to be, to me, there's a whole lot of stuff that goes on in there in the space of that controversy.
Yeah, and in a way, you got to ask yourself, why is there controversy? You know, he wins and he receives, he's a recipient of the Navy Cross. He fights his way at the top of Suribachi. He raises a flag, maybe not the flag, which actually was the second one. It's not like it's a stolen valor issue or something.
No.
And you can acknowledge the confusion and the number that were killed later and, you know, which flag raising. I'll bet you the Marines that raised the first flag looking at the picture of the second flag might not even been able to tell if that was not the flag they raised. I mean, I think we overthink sometimes these things. And nobody thought when they were putting it up they were creating the most iconic image that for the Corps and at that time for the country. I mean, when Forrest Gump saw the flag went up, he said, "You guaranteed a Marine Corps for 500 years or 1,000 years or whatever." You know, I mean, which was true. Even Harry Truman tried to get rid of him, couldn't do it after that. You know,
we love ourselves. Our lobbying arm is pretty strong. Well, although we don't lobby officially, in terms of resources that you've had access to, obviously, you're in a unique position as a CO of 9th Marines over there. But, anything that, in any material that you've seen that people that are interested in this, you'd point them in that direction?
The archives, and the Marine Corps Research Center at Quantico have a lot of, when you get into the unit diaries and you get into reading about the reports at the time, that's the most fascinating stuff when you get down into there. One thing that disappointed me as a former CO of 9th Marines when the decision was made, when we were going to cut a regiment out, we cut the 9th Marines out. And what was significant of that, it was the last EWO unit in the regiment in the Marine Corps. And you would think he'd preserve the last regiment that fought on EWO. So that was a personal thing.
I would think that you didn't have enough juice to shut that one down. What happened?
No, because the commandant at the time had been CO of 4th Marines, and it was going to be between the 4th and the 9th.
There you have it. The interesting. No, I mean, I read General Erskine's after I got my hands on it.
Met his wife, a long talk with her. I mean, a wonderful lady. She's since passed away. But she was so pleased that someone was interested in her husband. And again, at that time it was Holland, Mads, Smith, Geiger, and right. Vandegrift. But at the time, the respect he had from the other general officers, from his peers, was phenomenal. But somewhere in the midst of history, he's become someone who we don't really hear much or talk much about, It's kind of sad that it came that way because, you know, he was so highly regarded at the time.
Well, I will tell you, sir, I don't know that without your narrative of what he did on Iwo Jima, I don't know that I would ever read the oral history that I found. I actually found it when I was taking a book back on Thanksgiving Day, I want to say in 1991, to the old library in Quantico, and they had left the door open to the library. And I went in there, and the my wife was pissed at me, but the special collection room was open. And so here I am Thanksgiving Day in the library. I shut the door after I got in, and I there's no alarm back then, right? And so I'm in the special collections room, and I find it, and I sit down, and I just start reading it, and that I made a copy of it, and that I still have today. And but it's fascinating, those first person, to me, those first person accounts, when you hear them using pronouns like I and we, as opposed to somebody else writing it and using they and he, are absolutely fascinating, and they're just dripping with leadership lessons, and his is phenomenal. His is great. Was it still part of the documents with 9th Marine Regiment? Oh, is that how you found it? Where did you find it?
No, I found it at Quantico. The okay. regiments don't keep historical archives documents, but obviously, of course, since General Gray created the research center at Quantico, that's a treasure trove of those sorts of things. So, you know, it's really worth going back into the bowels of the library and finding things like that. And especially with the emphasis on oral histories, that started with those people before they died, and has continued on now. So, that's something that's critically important, I think, for the future as we go back and look at it. I'm writing a paper on innovation, by the military in the Pacific during World War II, because the number of innovative things that they, both the commands did out there, MacArthur's and Nimitz's, were amazing, you know. It was the first time they went experienced carrier warfare, amphibious operations, but they created units like UDT. They created technology, different kinds of landing craft to influence development. The Raider units, the Code Talkers. I mean, it was just like a big experimental lab in the middle of combat. And a lot's been written about innovation in interwar periods, you know, lessons learned from the previous war or looking ahead to the next one. But no place I found in history was innovation and non-traditional approaches, whether it was strategy, operations, tactics, technology, processes, procedures, structure, ever comes close to the Pacific Command's during that war.
You know, so I did a paper when I was at Fort Knox. They sent me to the Armored Corps on my way back to be an infantry company commander, and I had to write a paper on armor in the Pacific. And instead of doing research and writing, because I just come from Quantico and had done that, teaching at IOC, I made out a form, and I started calling veterans who fought in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th tank battalions. Did the 3rd tank battalion go ashore?
I don't think so.
Right, so it would have been the 4th and 5th tankers, tank battalions. And you talk about fascinating interviews. First of all, they screwed with everything. They were on those islands between fights, getting ready, and they screwed, I mean, and because of the draft and everybody coming in the military, they had guys who did metal, they had guys who did optics, they had everybody there, which is, I think, a little bit different than we are today. And so they, you know, they had spaced armor. They made forms out of wood and they filled it with concrete. And so they had spaced armor. They welded penny nails on top, and they welded tracks to turret to thicken armor. So, and it was fascinating to hear how these guys screwed with everything to make it better, to give them a better chance to survive. And so interesting. And as you said, during the conflict itself.
Yeah, you know, one little story. You know, it wasn't directly related to Iwo Jima, but because of the units that were created out there, and they're, although they poked at each other, the respect they had for each other. When UDT was created out there by Kelly Turner, the head of the amphibious forces, and they were doing their business, and sometimes they would get ashore, sneak ashore ahead of the landing or something. They would leave little signs, you know, with an arrow saying, Marines, go this way to the enemy. They would tease each other. And so there was a move afoot back in Washington in Congress to give UDT extra pay. And so when they got the word out there that this was what Congress wanted to do, they approached the UDT commander out there who had formed them and created them and said, this is what they want to do. And he said, let me talk to my people first. So he talked to his people. He came back. He says, my guys won't accept any additional pay unless every Marine rifleman gets the same. So, I mean, that yeah, that kind of shows you the cross-respect from they had, you know, because even those Navy drivers of those landing craft and everything, I mean, they were in the thick of things. I mean, that was your only firepower close in when you hit the beach, too.
Right, right. You know, Iwo Jima, you know, one of the interesting wake-up calls is on D-1 when they're going to execute a little bit of a reconnaissance, and those Navy guys get the shit shot out of them. I mean, there's one of the first indicators that, yeah, maybe that bombardment didn't do what we thought it was, because those, I can't remember what the LS, whatever the hell it is, but I don't know. I want to say there was about 14 of them that went towards the beach and had various missions, and I don't know how many they lost and how many casualties they have, but it wasn't a pretty day for the Navy the day before. And so, interesting. So what's the lasting legacy of Iwo Jima?
Well, I mean, it's an iconic battle.
In your mind.
Well, in my mind, when you look at the symbolism that came out of there, the nature of the battle, most medals of honor in any battle in history, you know, certainly in World War II, the highest percentage of casualties taken in such a short period of time, and everything that made the battle even more iconic, everything from John Wayne and Sands of Iwo Jima, you know, it defined the Marine Corps. At that point, the Marine Corps became something that maybe John Lejeune had dreamed it would be, and not just posts and stations. Obviously, World War One with the Marine Brigade being in there showed something different, but that was treated like an aberration. No one really thought Marines could form as 6 divisions and 4 air wings and fight on that scale, and that was an all-Marine operation too, where some of the other campaigns like Okinawa, it was a mix. And so to our service in the Marine Corps, it was a defining moment. It was a defining battle that changed who we were, and what we were. Not that we didn't have those same kinds of characteristics before, but it was sort of the proving moment, more than, and of course there were other operations that Peleliu had the highest number of casualties, you know, given the size of force and everything. But this one, because of its scope and everything, it was, I think, and it was the stepping stone to either Formosa or Okinawa, and then the final battle. And like I said before, it was the first piece of Japanese terrain taken, and actually belonged to the prefecture of Tokyo, so it was even more psychologically important. And there's always been an argument as to whether we should have taken it or not, or bypassed it, and whether it was worth it. But you know what? One thing that people don't realize is those bombers that were striking Japan not only needed a place to recover if they were hit, and actually there was a plane landed there during the battle, but they needed fighter coverage, and the fighters didn't have the legs coming out of the Marianas, so Iwo Jima gave them the legs. Had we invaded Japan, that would have been a critical base, too, along with Okinawa.
And I think the number of KIA is approximately equal to the number of Air Force airmen that landed on the island afterwards. And I mean, you can mess with that footnote. I've got an email for you, sir, and I'll let you go.
Okay.
Mac, first of all, what an awesome conversation about Iwo Jima this morning. Fascinating to listen to, given the general's experience. I'm curious if he could point us to a couple of books that he would recommend that we read if we're interested in studying more about Iwo Jima.
Actually, there's a book that's coming out on Iwo Jima, and for the life of me, I don't have the title. It's written by a former Marine officer who spent the last couple of years on the island and talking, obviously, to not only Marines going through the archives and everything, but he managed to find Kobayashi's son. So he spends a lot of time to talking about the Japanese side in much more detailed way than maybe Bradley's son did in Flags of Our Fathers. And then, you know, when Clint Eastwood did the movie looking at Letters from Iwo Jima, the other part of it. But I can't remember, off the top of my head, I don't have, he had sent me a draft that I looked at just maybe a couple weeks ago. And I don't have right off the top of my head. That's what happens when you get old. but look for a new book on Iwo Jima coming out. I think his last name's Briggs Riley.
Riley?
It's a hyphenated, yeah, Briggs Riley, like a hyphenated last name.
Got it. All right. Other than Briggs Riley, anything, any older books that you'd recommend?
You know, the old volumes of the amphibians came to conquer.
Right.
Because I think sometimes as Marines, we get focused on the battle ashore or the landing. It's really important to understand how the whole amphibious business evolved. And Admiral Kelly Turner, who was really the father of making this happen, you know, he commanded all the amphibious forces in the Pacific. One interesting note is how much MacArthur valued amphibious operations. When he first drew up the Operation Cartwheel, which is going from Australia and New Guinea to the Philippines, which is his focus, and then Formosa, he planned and wanted to execute 13 amphibious landings and really was pressing the Navy to give him the capability. And they were fighting him because Nimitz obviously wanted to keep the amphibious forces in the Central Pacific, because, you know, he wanted to go up through the Gilbert's and Marianas and then over. So the fight for amphibious forces and how they went from, no one had done anything like this, although there was thinking about it in Quantico from the 20s and 30s, how it evolved, because the first fights were, they were almost catastrophic. I mean, Guadalcanal, Vandegrift said, I need the Navy to be around for 12 days so I get my stuff off to fight. The Navy left after 6, and he was left with less than half the stuff he needed. Japanese were piling onto the island, and what was interesting is how they used the Japanese supplies that were there and the Japanese equipment, and then the Cactus Air Force and how it formed. It was just planes, like Navy planes off the carriers that made emergency landings, the Marine squadrons that were there. Then there was some Air Force and Australian that landed there because they got shot up or anything. So this, it was a huge together bunch of different aircraft that Pappy Boynton and others put together. But it's just fascinating to see how all this went through. And when you look at the end at Okinawa, I mean, everybody focuses on D-Day in Normandy, but much of that was a shore-to-shore, you know, going from the U.K. across. When you look at Okinawa and you look at the number of ships, I mean, it may be the purest of amphibious operations in terms of total projection from the sea, virtually, except for maybe long-range bombers. But it, yeah, it was sort of the culminating event of the whole concept of amphibious operations that after Gallipoli, no one ever thought, you know, would happen again.
Interesting. No, and again, you know, there's been interesting articles written recently in the Gazette about, you know, given the lethality of surface to, you know, ship missiles, of surface to surface missiles, of air to surface missiles, will we ever see amphibious operations like that again, or will we move to different ways to do those things? So interesting stuff.
I think you kill the targeting system, then you don't have to worry about the missiles.
You know,
how they going to find you? See,
I don't think we pay enough attention.
We're always trying to kill the missiles. Missiles are useless if you can't see what they're supposed to hit, especially if you're at sea and moving around. We go after the wrong approach.
Well, you know, I said that about, you know, the whole hysteria that surrounds hypersonic weapons. I said, well, okay, so how do they acquire the target? Okay, so they can knock the face, they can knock Roosevelt's face off Mount Rushmore. Okay, I got it. It's a fixed target. They load it up and they shoot it. All right, but a dynamic target, how do they do it? And they don't have an answer to that. So anyway.
Well, the answer is either kill the targeting system or deceive it. You know, I mean, be imaginative.
Well, you know, and we've gone through this. I mean, sir, the spiral of technology and weapon system from the time of the slingshot and rock throwing to where we are today. And as of yet, there hasn't been a weapon system that hasn't been able to be defeated in some way, shape, or form. I hope at some other time, sir, you'll come back and talk about Vietnam. I'd love to have a conversation with you about, you know, the different aspects of Vietnam. You were there both as an advisor and as a company commander. And I've had some great, great conversations. One with a great friend of yours, Butch Neal, came on a couple times and talked to me about India Company 3-9 and the Battle of Gatlin's Corner, which begot squad leaders from that company coming on, which I think, unless I'm wrong, is the single most decorated action in Marine Corps history. Just fascinating stuff. I'd love to have you come on and talk a little bit about your Vietnam experiences, leadership in Vietnam, both as an advisor and then as a company commander sometime.
Sure.
All right. Sir, first of all, thanks so much for doing this. I've wanted to do it for years. You first triggered my interest in Iwo Jima, and I think it's one of the most interesting battles. The heroism, the way it's documented, I think it might be the most photographed battle in American history.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, and there's a ton to learn, everything from the first, first casualties were flown off that island during the battle, which tended not to happen, the first use of whole blood there, and a whole bunch of things that you can find out about Iwo Jima. So thank you very much for doing this.
Sure thing, Mac. It all starts with steak and eggs in the morning.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
All right.
There you have it. The one and only, Anthony C. Zinni. Here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. We'll take a break. See if we can dial up the gunner. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
Hundreds of thousands of veterans have taken off their uniforms and put them away, carefully packed and safely stowed. But for some veterans, the uniform isn't so easily removed. The emotions experienced while serving continue to weigh on them. Life after service is different. Many veterans find transitioning difficult, and daily life is no longer as enjoyable as it once was. Some feel overwhelmed and lost. But that uncertainty doesn't take away from their strength and courage, nor does it take away from the sense of duty veterans carry with them. The transition from service is different for everyone. If you are a veteran going through a difficult time, or know one who is, the power of one person, one connection, one act of compassion can make a difference. For free.